This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, world. This is the Global Media and Communication Podcast Series. I am Aswin Punathambekar, the director of the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication.
This is Jing Wang, the senior research manager at CARC.
Our podcast is part of a multimodal project powered by CARG here at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
At CARG, we produce and promote critical, interdisciplinary, and multimodal research on global media and communication. We aim to bridge academic scholarship and public life, bringing the very best scholarship to bear on enduring global questions and pressing contemporary issues.
The title is actually one that I didn't come to until fairly late in the project. I was interested in, you know, a descriptive title that would not be seeming to make the claim to be telling the history of Latino TV. I think it's very important that I have the subheading that it's a history and not the history. I do think that it's an important step in that this is actually the first book that is, you know, beginning to explore a chronological trajectory of Latino representation and authorship in U.S. English language television.
That is Mari Beltran, Associate Professor in the Department of Radio, Television, and Film at the University of Texas at Austin. And I am your host for this episode, Lucila Rosas, PhD student at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and fellow at CARC. In today's episode, Professor Beltran and I discuss Latino TV, a history, a fascinating account of Latino participation and representation in U.S. English language television. Let's begin. Professor Beltran, thank you so much for joining us today.
What sparked your interest in the topic, and how did you begin imagining it as a book?
Well, the roots of this book go back decades, actually, to my years in graduate school in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And at that time, I wrote a seminar paper that was my first attempt at better understanding why Latinos at that time were so underrepresented in what was then mostly broadcast television, even as we were becoming the largest non-white ethnic group and were also known to be avid TV watchers. It was a subject that I then began coming back to over the years as I did research on I Love Lucy, Chico and the Man, and other series, and was also interviewing Latinx media professionals for other research projects. And as the Latino TV audience has continued to grow dramatically in the numbers of, you know, Latinx professionals hired to work in television has not grown dramatically, I felt increasingly that there was a need for a book-length study that would begin to explore some of the histories for Latinos in English language TV, which is only one facet of exploring Latinx television. But I felt like perhaps this book could begin to encourage other scholars also to really develop, other projects in Latinx television studies.
So related to this, how does this book figure in your broader scholarly trajectory and identity? And what conversations in Latinx studies, in media and communication studies, do you engage with in the book?
Well, as a scholar, I guess I would say that I've aimed to illuminate how social hierarchies and cultural citizenship, or like having a voice and agency in society through the media, are manifest in US television and film and also celebrity culture. And through that, often with the focus on Latinos and on female voices and representation. And so I feel that the book has been, very much a part of this trajectory in, exploring this particular, this particular medium and various histories within that. Definitely it has always felt that, U.S. television studies and histories have often left out Latinas and Latinos, and that television has often been left out of Latina and Latino cultural histories and studies. And so I've really hoped that I can raise questions about television story worlds and production cultures and how particular social groups are represented or not represented within, within those spaces, and then the impact of that. Also to raise questions about definitions of the American audience in relation to Latinos and women. And then certainly in Latino cultural studies, like thinking about how to define like definitions of Latino activism and cultural labor in relation to television, I think are areas that are, really we could do more work within. And so I hope those are ways in which I'm contributing.
I know like you've mentioned this aspect of like cultural citizenship, and so I wanted to ask you about this concept that you use, because you use a concept such as cultural citizenship, also Amaya citizenship excess, and also citizen deficit, and Gloria Anzaldúa's making faces, and you feature this concept centrally in your book. So can you explain a bit more about how they help you frame this work?
Sure. I was really interested in breaking out of the typical methods of, study of what appears on TV screens, of simply looking at characters and narratives, instead to investigate and document the evolution of Latinos breaking into the television industry, having an impact on the narratives, and ultimately beginning to tell their own stories. I was inspired in part by also by Ella Shohat and Robert Stamm's discussion of focalization, or the dynamics of having a voice and putting it out there as a method of study of media representation that could tell us much more than simply study of stereotypes, which traditionally had been the way that people began looking at Latino representation. And so, I found that the concepts of cultural citizenship and of Anzaldúa's notion of haciendo caras, or making face, that these were ways that I could articulate this concept in relation to television storytelling, which is what I decided to center in my research. And so I found, I found that, offered me a way to just really focus on, when did Latinos begin to have a voice in the production, in the writer's room, and when did they actually begin to lead writer's rooms and truly be telling their own stories? And once I decided on that, structuring the book project became a lot easier.
So let's maybe talk about the book structure. I was I was like thinking about the title, just like starting with the title, which is Latino TV, A History. So it seems to be suggesting that this is maybe one of the possible histories on this topic. So I wanted to ask you, why do you think this particular history of Latino TV is important among many others that could be told? And if you can tell us a bit about the particular conjuncture that made it urgent and relevant to excavate this story, this history.
The title is actually one that I didn't come to until fairly late in the project. I was interested in, you know, a descriptive title that would not be seeming to make the claim to be telling the history of Latino TV. I think it's very important that I have the subheading that it's a history and not the history. I do think that it's an important step in that this is actually the first book that is, you know, beginning to explore a chronological trajectory of Latino representation and authorship in US English language television. But there was no way that this book or any one book could fully explore the topic or all of the television series that might be discussed or all of the media professionals who were involved in making them. So I did very much want to highlight that it was just my version, one historian's version of the stories that could be told. And I did think it was, you know, I feel like the timing was important because I was able to interview some professionals who are much, you know, really getting older and will soon perhaps not be around or be able to relate what they remember from their time working in television or working as an actor in some cases. And so I'm glad I was able to capture some of those stories. But I very much feel like this book is just a beginning and hopefully is going to inspire and encourage other scholars to begin to fill in more gaps and tell all of the many stories that I wasn't able to tell or chose not to tell within this version of Latinos in TV.
So also related to like the book structure and just like thinking about how it is organized chronologically, can you tell us about why did you decide to start by discussing kids' TV westerns of the 1950s? Did you consider any other starting points to begin your exploration? I think because you have such a big like corpus of let's say data or things that you might be like looking at. I just like wonder how did you decide to start with this and then like do this like chronological like organization for the book?
Let's see. I'll answer first the question just about chapter one, and then maybe I could talk a little bit about how I ended up deciding on the organization in the process. Just to talk about chapter one, which focuses on the Cisco Kid and the Disney series about El Fuego Baca and the animated series that I focused on as well. I ended up making kids' TV westerns the focus because I felt that illuminating the duality of what we might call the duality of Latinx representation. If you think about the Cisco Kid and Pancho, who was his sidekick, this idea that there often will be a so-called good Latino hero who is very somewhat European in style and the way he spoke, paired with a comical sidekick who spoke broken English and was much more indigenous looking and was, you know, perhaps the bad Latino to the good Latino. I really wanted to explore that because I felt like that if I could understand and help readers understand that this duality is still sometimes seen in contemporary images and narratives And certainly the kind of criminal Latino characters we sometimes see, you know, has some connections to the Pancho character, even though Pancho was seen as more of a heroic figure. I felt like this is, there are traces of some of our contemporary trends in Latino representation that we could find in those 50s shows. So that's partly why I chose that as a starting point. And also, I just happened to find a lot of archival material about these shows that would allow me to explore them in depth. But as people might guess, I had considered beginning with an in-depth focus on I Love Lucy in the 1950s as well. But ultimately, you know, I decided that I Love Lucy and Desi Arnaz's success within that show and as a performer generally, and also as a TV executive later, was more of an anomaly than a success that spawned changes in subsequent decades in the TV industry. Like, I think that only in maybe the recent decade do we really see kind of a connection of a Latino performer going on to become an executive and producer. And so I just didn't, it just seemed like it was a success and it was unique and in some ways didn't change the industry. I also had done research and written on Desi Arnaz and I Love Lucy in my previous book. And I wasn't sure that I had more to say about it. And I didn't really feel like I should just reprint a former chapter in this new book. And so I included some of that material in the introduction of the book instead. And so that is how I began to talk more about what I chose to do in terms of organizing the book as a whole. It really took time to come to decide how I might structure it. It was a challenge. In the first years of the project, I realized I had to initially try to gather as much information as I could about series and pilots that had been produced that included lead Latino characters. And there wasn't really one place where I could find all of that. And so I spent time just creating my own chronology of shows that were proposed. If I could find that information, that was especially difficult if it didn't make it to pilot or that pilot didn't go to season to actually have a whole season. But I just worked on compiling information on all of the TV shows that I could find. And I did focus on strictly on English language television that was mostly primetime and mostly for adults. But I did that. I began to try to interview media professionals that worked on those shows. And as I was doing this, I was looking to see, like, were there archives where I might access some production information or where I might access actual taped episodes. As I talk about in the book, like, most of this material is not archived and most of it's actually not preserved in any way that I could find. But based on gathering, like, sometimes, as I was mentioning, related to the Cisco Kid, like, if I could find archival material, I knew that that would help me to tell a story about a particular decade or a particular era. So it was really over time, as I saw what I had, that I began to organize the book into chapters. I wasn't sure initially if it would be decade by decade, but I wanted to show change over time. So I knew ultimately it would be chronological in the way I would depict it. But like, certainly with the chapter on 80s and 90s failed series, I could have picked a few different series to focus on instead of the two that I made the foot. And initially I thought, oh, well, I'll just try to tell all of the stories, but it became overwhelming. I realized for readers, there wouldn't be a story. So I really tried to think about how to tell a story about each era that would, you know, really make sense. And I know each chapter is a bit different because different things were happening, but, and then over time, it also, I came to structure it around writers having greater agency and beginning to tell more nuanced stories, I think, as a result of that. And also just in relation to how television changed, I think in the 80s, viewers weren't necessarily expecting really complicated stories. Whereas now, if we are, you know, watching maybe streaming television in particular, I think we often expect a very complex story, and that we think we're going to have well-developed characters. And so I think that some of the greater nuance of Latinx representation is just kind of following how TV has evolved more generally too.
No, I think it works, the way you've organized the book works pretty well. And I can also see kind of like, it's easy to see how things like change and overlap. So I think it's an amazing work. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about the amount of things you had to like look at, because you said you had to do some archival research, and you combined this with interviews as well. So I was just like thinking about how it was for you to put together the traces of this history, especially in the cases when it was like difficult to find information because some of the series were not preserved, right? Or maybe there was one chapter that was like preserved here and there, and you could not find all of the information. So how were you able to like filling these gaps, maybe, or how were you able to articulate all of this like information, the different sources, and also articulate what you were like looking at in the archives with the interviews?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because actually a lot of the materials I found were not in archives. And so I did searches on eBay and Google and Amazon, and often having to look for what are called extra textual traces of these shows. And so that could be an ad that had appeared in TV Guide, a poster that was made to promote a show. Sometimes also the promotional bumpers, the kind of mini commercials that the broadcast networks used to show in between their TV shows that would promote another show to encourage people to watch it. And so for some TV shows, what I might find would be a 30-second commercial. For others, I only might find a film poster. And so, I mean, that is, you know, that would mean it would be very difficult to make that actually a case study of the chapter. But I could use, you know, I could use those artifacts to talk about a whole decade, to kind of, you know, show some of the trends in those kinds of promotions for all of the shows that featured Latina or Latino lead characters. So I usually didn't know what I could find. Like sometimes I got lucky and someone that I interviewed, a professional who'd been working for two decades, gave me a DVD that included episodes of a show called AKA Pablo that ran in the mid 80s. And I would never have seen these episodes, but they were shared with me. And so it really, I mean, there were, I guess we would call them like armchair collectors who used to videotape what they watched on television and then actually took the time to then transfer them to later media forms so that they could be preserved and watched, like, you know, in this case on a DVD player. And sometimes that's the only existing copy that I have and that actually cannot be found in a library. So it was a lot of detective work and just really being persistent and kind of maintaining files on each of the series and then just looking everywhere that I could for traces of those shows. I also could find reviews sometimes by TV critics that were published in newspapers and are, you know, available through library databases. And so I just tried to look at every possible angle for each show And sometimes I was very lucky. And, you know, there are a few shows, even going back to the 80s, that are preserved at the Library of Congress or the UCLA Film and Television Archive. And so it was, you know, I just looked at every potential archive and did what I could to compile all of that. In fact, I've realized I need to create, I'd like to find a way to give access of that material to future scholars. And so that's something that I'm thinking about making possible, you know, through my own like university cloud space and that sort of thing, or perhaps through the university library at Texas.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
I think it is also amazing that you were able to find all of these traces, because I feel like now maybe it will be easier to find some of the stuff that's, I don't know, being streamed or in television right now, because it can be more like as easily digitalized. But there's also maybe a lot of decisions around what to preserve and what not, depending on the resources you have. Or so I was wondering if you think that maybe the lack of access to some of the material you have, or the lack of public access to the material that you were like ultimately able to compile is related to some decisions about like what was like worthy of preservation and what was not worthy of preservation in the archives.
Yeah, that's a really great point. You know, I think that television has not been typically valued as highly as film in relation to the idea of preservation. There are many, many film archives, and certainly there is some archived television now, but I think that it's still relatively recent that I think, you know, archivists have thought about archiving television. And I think that the more that we see scholarly publications on television, the more it might be considered a cultural artifact that is meaningful and, you know, definitely worthy of preservation. And so that's a great point. I hope that my book does play some role in that regard.
So I wanted to touch on one transversal argument of your book, that is that there seems to be a marked absence and also disregard of Latino, Latina, Latinx writers, producers, and actors, and that like impacts representation on TV and also says something about like the lack of Latino authorship on TV. And you argue that more than just impacting the possibilities of success of many TV series featuring Latino stories between the 1970s and 1990s, it also affected how Latinidad was understood as related to U.S. national identity. There seems to have been some sort of change maybe by the 2010s that maybe led to the inclusion of more Latinx people in the roles in front and behind the camera. So I just like wanted to ask you what changed, even though it seems that there are like very timid, very like small changes, like what changed between the previous decades and what happened in the 2000s?
What a great question. I mean, I think that there are answers that are societal and have had an impact on who works in the media industries and what gets produced. And then I think there are also answers that are much more linked specifically to like the media industries and media watching. To address the societal changes, you know, another thing that I learned more about that I hadn't fully thought about before I did this project is the fact that it's really in the 1970s that U.S. Latinos are more U.S. Latinos are able to go to college, and the first generation of Latinos in the U.S. that worked in television were college students and college graduates for the most part, and second generation Latinos for the most part who often had a very different situation than their parents had had. And so I do think that it's taken, and is it partly linked to education? Many, many more Latinos have moved into the middle class in the U.S. as well. And so I think that there's been a status, you know, a major status evolution for U.S. Latinos linked to education and class and opportunity that are, you know, all those things being linked. So there's that. And then in relation to the media industries in particular, you know, I think that by the 2000s that we witnessed the entrance of a number of Latino writers and producers, a greater number of Latino actors who had achieved some celebrity status, you know, who could be seen as the potential star of a TV show. And also we had witnessed by the 2000s other Latino performers outside of TV, especially I'm thinking of Selena, who, you know, really proved that there was a profit to be made in various media industries in the U.S. from popular Latino and Latina performers. And I think all of those things made a difference in TV executives having more interest in greenlighting TV series with Latino lead characters. So, like, and then every series that was successful, like, especially George Lopez and Ugly Betty, you know, I think that each show, you know, had a positive impact to encourage the next show. And then I think also TV executives were becoming a lot more aware that most U.S. Latinos were bilingual and did watch at least some English language TV. Whereas I think in the 70s, there really was often the mythology that Latinos only watched Spanish language television. So there'd been some pretty big mindset changes, I think, even though we still really don't see, we do not see enough TV shows today that are really representing Latinos in a dominant way. So we still have a lot of room to grow. It's not, the numbers are not necessarily much better than they were in the 2000s.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I related to that. I was also thinking about how this more like rich portrayal of Latinidad, this richer portrayal of Latinidad and in TV series right now can have impact or has been impacting recent views of Latinidad and U.S. national identity. So what I wanted to know is, how do you see that these changes of in authorship and representation have impacted also depictions of like race, class, and gender as related to Latinidad? Like, how do we see this diversification? And maybe you can also give me some examples of like maybe characters or series that amplify this representation or this complexity.
Well, we definitely are seeing examples of, you know, Latino characters that are not Mexican-American, that are not, you know, heterosexual, that are of, you know, different ages and classes and situations. You know, I think the shows that I admire the most in this regard are ones that are very much informed by the experiences of their creators. A show like Vida, which is about two sisters who do happen to be Mexican-American, and so that's something we've seen very, very often. But these are two sisters who have left their original neighborhood in East Los Angeles and have gone on to different lives and return and are in the middle of, you know, issues over gentrification of their former neighborhood, who, you know, have connections to, you know, Mexican-American people who grew up in their neighborhood, who identify very differently in terms of, you know, class and their religious affiliation and sexuality. And ultimately, it's a very, you know, queer identified narrative that's very, you know, female centric. And I think that this is the kind of work that Tania Saracho has been known for as a playwright prior to her coming to television to work as a television writer and creator. There have been other shows more recently also that have focused on Venezuelans and Dominican Americans and Cuban Americans, and it's becoming much more common it used to be that we could assume that every television series with a major Latino character, that the character would be Mexican American or Mexican. And that, I think, is really finally beginning to change. And I definitely am seeing, you know, many more narratives that are focusing on, you know, class divisions and racial divisions among Latino communities and mixed communities with a large, you know, Latino community within it. And so it's really refreshing to see different kinds of stories, you know, beginning to be told. But I mean, there still is this, it seems to be a preference, and perhaps it's because the TV industry is centered in the Los Angeles area, that perhaps when producers and writers think of creating a story about Latinos, like, it happens to be often situated in East LA. But there are beginning to be some stories that are set in other parts of the United States and outside the United States as well. So hopefully this is a new trend that is going to grow.
So one thing, now that we're like talking about authorship and representation, it seems, and many like media and communication scholars have argued that representation has its limits, especially in the current moment, because of there has been a proliferation of differences in media, and there's also a big emphasis of visibility for visibility safe, and maybe that has made us like reach a point in which representation is like limited in helping to achieve social change. And so, considering this in the current moment of streaming services and digital media, that has led to an abundance of TV content, what do you think representation still matters in the case of Latino TV, particularly in the context of the U.S.?
Well, I think in bringing up the work of Herman Gray and Sarah Benet Weiser on these questions is interesting, because I do think, you know, in fact, like my choice to do as much as I could focus the book on cultural citizenship as opposed to just solely representation is in part trying to address this issue. Like, there are times, I think, in terms of the construction of sometimes a Latino character within a television series that's actually about more about maybe the white lead characters. Like, there have been times in which these Latino characters have felt like visibility for visibility's sake. And then there are moments now that I've noticed as well in which there seems to be a Latino queer character for whom like their sexual identity isn't really fully developed in a way that makes sense within the storyline. And then it can feel like it's an intersectional Latino representation also for visibility's sake. So I do think that can happen. But I think if we focus more on Latino cultural citizenship and authorship within television, we can be looking more closely at whether Latino perspectives are actually included or are not. And so in this way, I think narratives that are reflecting Latino perspectives, I think if they're included, that they still matter, and especially in this recent era in which, you know, we're really having to fight against a kind of, you know, white supremacist mindset. And so, you know, and as Latinos are now 20% just about of the American population, or 1 in 5 Americans, you know, there's really still an urgent need for more Latino media professionals and executives, and for more portrayals of Latinos and more nuanced portrayals of Latinos, both in children's programming and in adult programming.
I found really interesting in your book was the role of activists, because we're also involved in TV production, and that help maybe like doing some important like changes in public TV in the 60s and 70s, I believe. And I was like thinking if you can tell us a bit more about what do you think are the legacies of this moment of public television, in what will come later on in terms of Latino TV in the U.S.?
Well, you know, I feel that the 60s and 70s Latino public affairs series marked the moment when U.S. Latinx lives, you know, as they were really lived, became the focus of TV programming. It also marked the moment when Latinos began to work as television producers for the first time, making decisions about what would go on the screen. There were times when there were limitations to how revolutionary these programs could be, especially if they were funded by the Ford Foundation, which a lot of them were. But there were some ways that producers worked to get around that. John Noriega has done research on this also, that at times in the programming, some content was included in Spanish, and the public TV employees that were working around them often didn't speak Spanish, and things slipped by. It did make a difference back then. I mean, they had funding from the Ford Foundation for many of these programs. It turned out the funding dried up for the most part by the early 1970s. And so it was a kind of short-lived window that had a lot of promise. After that, like different public TV stations have had Latino-focused shows ever since, but there wasn't the same number around the country at different public TV stations as there was in that time. I think that there was, you know, a real activist impulse that drove many of the Chicano and New Yorican and other Latino producers and white producers also who were interested in working on the programming. I think that activist impulse, we can still see it sometimes, I think, in the minds of, you know, Latinx creators today who are interested perhaps in, you know, being part of the commercial media industries, but also in like presenting very nuanced and sympathetic portrayals of Latinx people of all different backgrounds, and so I think that, you know, this interest in putting our lives out there on the screen is still not that different from what some of the producers of the 1970s might have been thinking about when they were making these nonfiction shows.
So I just have a few more questions so we can wrap it up. So one thing I was wondering is, have you built on this work since its publication, and how has this led to in terms of new ideas, conversations, and maybe projects that you have?
So, you know, I'm still sorting through where I may go with this next in relation to, you know, I'm very interested in what's happening for Latino-focused shows and the writers that are working on their shows in recent years. You're probably aware that the writer strike, there's a writer strike going on right now. And much of what's been put forth as the main concerns that the writers are trying to fight for are things that I think are really especially affecting Latino writers, many of whom are working right now in streaming television. And also we've had a number of cancellations of shows that began a few years ago. One thing I've thought about is working on perhaps a project that would put me on a set, you know, or in a writer's room, focused on, you know, what that process is in relation to perhaps making decisions about whether some cultural details are too specific, so that some members of an audience might not relate to it, or keeping all of those nuances within the storyline and kind of learning more about how that process works and using that to kind of shine a different light on Latinx television. Another possibility that's been suggested to me is perhaps making a documentary that would relate some of the information, some of my findings from my research, and then involve new interviews with the professionals that I interviewed as a part of the project. And thinking of this, I would of course be working with filmmakers because that's not my expertise. But the idea would be to create a documentary for a college or high school audience. And so that's something I'm really intrigued with.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to our Global Media and Communication podcast. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out through our email, cargc@asc.upenn.edu, or follow us on Twitter.
Until next time.
Thank you.